true crime and music history.
The Ants Human Stars Podcast with your host, Caleb
and Diego.
Are you ready?
Ready, steady, go. Yo, it's Diego again, and I'm going to talk about some true crime once again, something about funerals. I'll let you know a little bit later. And Caleb.
Hello, hello, hello. It's good to be back. I'm going to be telling you guys all about Walk This Way by Aerosmith and Run DMC. Excuse me, Run DMC and Aerosmith. There we go.
I'm excited. I want to hear all about it.
I love it.
I only recently just watched the
video?
Music video. Oh my God. Oh my God to that music video.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently the music was pretty huge when it came out. It's all over MTV. So I didn't know a whole lot about this song before. Well, I should say the details behind the song I did not know a lot about. I knew that going into it that they both were kind of just like, what the heck? Like, you know, Run DMC was like, eh. Aerosmith, and Aerosmith was kind of like, eh, who's Run DMC? that's all I knew. But actually, I got a better understanding of actually how they felt about each other, and we're going to dive into that today. So in August 1975, Aerosmith released Walk This Way as the second single from their third album, Toys in the Attic. It was then re-released in 1976, and then it became a top 10 hit for them. But fast forward 10 years later, and all their hits had pretty much dried up, and they were essentially like the band of the past. But leave it to Black folks to bring the dead back to life, okay? Which is just another reason as to why we all know Jesus was Black. But I digress. Okay. So I'm going to change things up today. I'm actually going to read an article done by Simon Price at The Guardian. I usually do my own write-ups, but his write-up was just done very, very well, and he got all the information in there. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make life easy. Working smarter, not harder.
I also just copy paste.
Yes. But I've added a few different pieces here and there. So all right, let's go ahead and dive into this. When Aerosmith's manager, Tom Collins, answered his phone one day in early 1986, he was at first confused. The voice on the other end belonged to Rick Rubin, the 22-year-old hip-hop producer and entrepreneur behind Def Jam, the fast-rising record label he had founded while still a film student at New York University, which I also want to mention. I don't think he mentions it in his article, but he was running the studio out of his dorm room. Okay, so this was literally like fresh. Yeah. So Ruben was a rock kid who'd grown up, or rather who hadn't, on the gonzo kicks of AC/DC, Ted Nugent, and Aerosmith themselves. And he wanted to talk to Collins about the idea of remaking the 1975 single Walk This Way with a rap group on his roster, Run DMC. Before Ruben could go into any further detail, Collins cut him off to request a little clarification. And it said that when he was on the phone with him, he asked, "What's rap?"
"You are so dumb."
I love it. "You are really dumb." It's a little understandable at the time. Rap was just starting. But a more valid question for most people in the mid-80s might have been, what's an Aerosmith? The suburban white kids who had grown up, who had once been the Boston band's faithful constituency, had matured and moved on. a new generation was turning instead towards exactly the hip hop sounds that Ruben and Def Jam co-founder Russell Simmons were selling them. Not that hip hop had always been an easy sell. The rap records that reached radio listeners in the early years had a tendency, ever since the Sugar Hill Gang's breakthrough Rapper's Delight, to exude a novelty flavor, while turntablist in real life, the beating heart of the culture, tended to manifest itself only as a cheesy wicked wicked add-on. The reputation of the entire genre was rescued by Run DMC, who, in the words of British writer Neil Kamkarni, in the periodic table of hip hop, quote, made everything that had happened before them sound old fashioned, too slick, and smarmy. Never heard of that word before, but there you go, ladies and gentlemen, smarmy. Let's okay. make that a trending thing for 2022. So the trio had roots in that clunky prehistory. Run, Joseph Simmons, the teenage brother of Russell Simmons, had previously DJed for Curtis Blow before forming his own band, originally called Orange Crush, with DMC, Daryl McDaniels, and DJ Jam Master J, Jason Mizell. So two things there. One, Run DMC was originally Orange Crush, which was like, wow, that actually okay. just makes me want orange soda. Two, I have met Daryl McDaniel, the first Comic-Con that I went to. He has a comic book, and I got the comic book and I met him and I have a picture with him, and he was very nice, great guy. So everything changed in 1983 when the trio renamed Run DMC and, still in their teens, released their debut single It's Like That on Profile. That track, brutally blunt by the standards of the time, and its rival dissing Flipside Sucker MCs, blew up on rap radio and changed the game for good. Ultimately, it took Run DMC with their black leather sweats, Hombergs, and in-your-face attitude to crystallize the image of toughness into rap chic. By the way, Hombergs are the hats that they wore, which were like these, like not fur, but that like felt material, I guess, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Nah,
anyways.
Nah, I got it. Nah, no,
yeah, that is. That's what a Hamburg is, because I didn't know what that was. So, and that was a quote by S.H. Fernando Jr. in Hip Hop History, The New Beats. Their attitude, like their beats, was hard. Their dress, unlike the extravagant leather sequins and feather outfits of most rap acts at the time, reflected a street aesthetic to which the average b-boy on the corner could relate. So, while Run DMC is just really blowing up and starting to make headway, Aerosmith, meanwhile, were in a slump. Album sales had steadily declined since their 70s peak. The band's key members were ravaged by various addictions, and they hadn't had a Billboard Top 10 single since the original Walk This Way a decade earlier.
Damn!
It was rough, okay? It was rough.
Shut up! Shut up!
Exactly. The song had first been recorded by the band's Toys in the Attic album and was born on tour when singer Steven Tyler, who had been listening to The Meters and James Brown, asked drummer Joey Kramer to lay down something with a little funk to it. Run DMC, therefore, were not so much appropriating Aerosmith's groove for Black culture as much as they were reclaiming it. Guitarist Joe Perry added a simple but effective hook, and Tyler came up with a lewd loss of innocence lyric about a schoolboy getting caught masturbating by his father, who instructs him in the ways of seduction, which I did not know that's what that song is about.
No,
I never really listened to the lyrics of the song. All I know is Walk This Way. Yeah, so there
okay.
you go. There you go.
All right.
When
Give
it was
it a
time.
Kiss.
You said what?
I'm like thinking of the lyrics and everything. That's what it was? Okay.
Right. Okay. When it was time to record the track at New York's Record Plant Studio, still needed a title and a chorus. Inspiration finally came when they took a break and walked a few blocks down to Times Square to catch a movie. The film was Mel Brooks's comedy Young Frankenstein, in which Marty Feldman's Igor lurches and limps down some stone steps, then instructs Gene Wilder, playing the title role, to, quote, walk this way. In a classic sight gag, Wilder does exactly that. I watched the clip. It's just very simple and straightforward, just like that. By the time Run DMC and Aerosmith's collaboration came about, Jam Master Jay had already been cutting Walk This Way back and forth between his decks for years. And Run had been rapping over it since he was 12. They weren't the first act, though, to attempt a rap-rock hybrid. The Beastie Boys' AC/DC sampling Rock Hard and LL Cool J's Rock the Bells, both Rick Rubin productions, had also walked that way. And Run DMC themselves had released several trial runs, notably the Russell Simmons-produced Rock Box and the provocatively titled King of Rock, both featuring chunky riffing from session guitarist Eddie Martinez. So I also wanted to say, he doesn't mention it in his article. Mr. Price doesn't mention it in his article, but it said that they didn't even know who Aerosmith was, like Run DMC, because even though they had been listening to the song, the DJs at the time would like cross out or rip off the sure. title for the artist so that other DJs couldn't like go find it and then use it again. So, you know, they're hearing, this is a whole new generation. They're hearing these songs for the first time. But they're not knowing who the artist is because, you know, they don't want the other DJs to take it. So all that to say that Run, who was rapping over the track, he had heard this song, but, you know, he didn't know who the band was. It was just like, oh yeah, we've been.
And you couldn't Google search.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So different times, folks. When Collins relayed Rubin's offer to Tyler and Perry, not Tyler Perry, Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, they were initially skeptical. But they went along to Magic Venture Studio in Manhattan on March 9th, 1986. Get this, for a rate of $8,000 a day. That's
spoken.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money. But a day was all it took. And Run DMC apparently had a rental car that was overdue and they needed to return, so they had to work fast. Yeah, they're like, we got to get this done. So it only took a day for them to get in there and do what they had to do. What Rick Rubin created with that day's work still stands as an immortal party anthem, as liable to spark outbreaks of air scratching as air guitar among drums, unable to decide whether they want to be Jay or Joe as they lurched around. An ability to dance was optional for the enjoyment of Walk This Way. Tyler's rapid-fire vocals was too slang-packed to be completely decipherable to British ears, but the bits about feet flying in the air, a kitty in the middle, and being down on the muffin left little doubt that this was thinly veiled filth. The video was also iconic. Okay, let's say that as we were talking about it, as we were talking about it earlier. The two bands, the sleazy old rock slags and the Box Fresh rap crew, are rehearsing in adjacent rooms and engaged in a loudness war. Both join forces when Tyler literally smashes down the wall between the two rooms, and the two groups storm a theater stage to the delight of screaming fans. The clip instantly took Run DMC into the MTV mainstream, so much so that the channel started showing it twice an hour. Also have to mention that, like, because of the success of this song, again, it really brought rap into the mainstream, which I just have to say, I really hate the term mainstream that's even used today, because really what people mean when they say mainstream is that white people are enjoying it and listening to it. So
exactly.
But yes, it really brought rap to the white suburban kids. And this is also, so this helped birth Yo MTV Raps that came a little later, and that was huge at the time. Simon Price asked also in his article, which half of this hookup were the real winners after this song, you know, debuted and took over? Who was doing a favor to whom or for whom? Rick Rubin had sold Aerosmith the idea as, quote, a great crossover opportunity for both groups. And so it proved. The received narrative is that the song broke Run DMC, and by extension, rap legitimizing the genre in the eyes of white listeners, just as Eddie Van Halen's solo on Beat It had done for Michael Jackson in Black Pop. It's true that the single became the first rap single on Billboard's top 10, peaking at number 4, that his parent album, Raising Hell, became rap's first platinum LP, and that Run DMC became the first rap act on the cover of Rolling Stone. So a lot did happen for Run DMC, but Aerosmith definitely benefited more. Run DMC were unquestionably the hipper, cooler, younger, and more current and relevant act. They've been the only rap artist on the Live Aid bill the previous year. Live Aid, if you don't know anything about that, that's Queen is the biggest. When you think of Live Aid in 85, you think of Queen's performance, because that's the only one people talk about. But there were so many more amazing artists that played at Live Aid. But just put in context, if you're listening and don't really know what Live Aid was. But the fact that the name Aerosmith appears nowhere on the label of the Run DMC version of Walk This Way speaks volumes about the balance of power. Guesting on a Run DMC single, albeit a cover of their own song, saved Aerosmith's career. It got them onto the contemporary hits radio format for the first time and achieved a different sort of crossover. If Run DMC's was racial, Aerosmith's was generational. Kids whose contemporary poodle rock heroes were Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, and Guns N' Roses welcomed Tyler and Perry as elder statesmen, and their next album, Permanent Vacation, sold 5 million copies, 10 times more than its predecessor, while the next two did even better. Mm-hmm. It also made them a truly global brand for the first time. Aerosmith, who had previously meant next to nothing in the UK, were suddenly household names. Run DMC, however, never quite consolidated that success. Their cultural visibility in later years restricted to Jason Nevins remixes and reproduction t-shirts in H&M, which I have to say plenty of Run DMC shirts in H&M. Meanwhile, the success of Walk This Way paved the way for a trio of white youths, Beastie Boys, to sell a hip-hop heavy metal hybrid back to the suburbs in even bigger quantities. Nowadays, the sheer popularity of Walk This Way means serious hip-hop heads are often dismissive of its worth. But to put the needle on the vinyl, even at 30 years distance, is to hear worlds colliding and walls tumbling down. So that's it. That's Simon Price's rundown of Walk This Way. I thought he did a pretty concise job. And I will say, with that end there, it kind of did hit me that, if you were to bring up those two names in a room, anybody, white, black, brown, Aerosmith, depending on the demographic, but Aerosmith is more seen widely as this legendary rock band, where Run DMC is like, oh, they're a big hip hop group, but they're not lauded in the same way that Aerosmith is, which I thought was, very, very interesting. Even despite, like I said, it did do very big things for Run DMC, but as far as longevity wise, Aerosmith kind of came out with more on top, which, again, I believe race plays a factor, because we've seen that over and over and over, where, whether it's collaborations between a white and black artist or a white artist redoing a black artist song, a lot of times they get more fame and more recognition from it, than, again, their black counterparts do. So, it's interesting.
That is, so now I know that Aerosmith used them to gain back their popularity.
Well, I will say, I don't know if you can say that they used them, because no one knew what the song was going to do.
But it was sort of,
but yes,
not
it
used
was
intentionally, but it was sort of like
they yeah, it was a way
to yeah, get, back get back into the game.
Yes, really, it was kind of like we have nothing to lose because there's nothing going on for them. So.
Yes, Run DMC did benefit, but yeah, it must have been, you know, on one side, was it just like, okay, this hit, this is luck, we're a one-hit wonder, or that the respect was ultimately paid more to Aerosmith and less to Run DMC, and it was sort of like, yeah, this was really good, but mostly because of Aerosmith. And you know, that may have been what people thought, you know. I hear the track again, and I'm like, okay, there's, like, the song is Aerosmith, yes, but there's the Aerosmith version, the Walk This Way, and I can hear it. And then there's... I feel like I'm listening. I'm in another space.
Yeah.
There's some black people in this room. Whereas in the other version, it's like, clear the black people, and this is just for white audiences only.
Well, was that? I mean, it was definitely just that they added more of that hip hop element. But I also will say, thinking about it just off the top of my head, rap changed a lot from 1986 to 1996, and it went from. And I've seen a couple hip hop, you know, documentaries on hip hop, and you know, rap went from being this fun,
right,
kind of kid and play, you know, rappers or MC Hammer to then hard. Yeah, by 96 you have Tupac and Biggie,
you got who guns. Are
yeah. So I will say, along with race, that probably played a factor in, again, Run DMC going on, because just the essence of the genre changed, and so those same big artists, those same rap artists that were big, you know, in the late 80s, you know, that was quote unquote played out. And again, I mentioned Kid in Play specifically because I watched a documentary with them, and they said specifically that that's kind of why they faded, because hip hop then became this, you had to be serious and tough and, you know, we're shooting people up and all this stuff. Yeah, it was no more this like, oh, we can just be fun and silly and, you know, just talk about trying to mack on girls and stuff. I'm sure that played a bit into it. And whereas with rock music, even though, you know, in the early 90s, you had the big grunge movement and you had, you know, Nirvana and stuff blowing up, rock was still had its place, as far as like still being front and center and having true rock hits. So the genre, while there were breakoffs, you know, Aerosmith's like classic rock was still able to sell. A whole decade later, because I mean they had, you know, hits into the 90s. I was crying when I met you.
All I think about like after the 80s is that track for that movie, Armageddon.
What track was that?
Don't wanna close my eyes.
Yeah. And I don't wanna miss a thing.
Yep. All of that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for this intersection of DMC and Aerosmith.
Look, again, black people come in and save the day, okay, and white people benefit from it. That's all I'm saying. I'm just saying.
That's so funny. And like, you know, in the video, they're probably like, Aerosmith looks like he's 50, you know.
That was those drugs, okay? Simon Price in his article said it nicely. He was like, oh, they had addiction. They were drug addicts, okay? And actually, again, there were a few other articles that I read from, but one of them was saying how Steven Tyler knew of hip-hop. Joe Perry, he didn't really know anything about hip-hop. And he knew, it was his stepson. I think I am correct in saying that it was his 13-year-old stepson Aaron who like introduced him to hip-hop. But Steven Tyler said he knew about it because he was like, I would be going around looking for drugs in New York. And he was like, where's the quote? I will give you I will give you the quote. Give me a second. So it says Tyler was immediately excited, according to and this is in his book, and he was talking about excited about, you know, doing this rap song. He said, quote, "I loved rap. I used to go looking for drugs on 9th Avenue, and I would go over to Midtown or downtown, and there would be guys on the corner selling cassettes of their music. I'd give them $1, $2, and that was the beginning of me noticing what was going on in New York at the time." So anyways, all that to say, okay, he was a drug addict.
Okay. Yeah, because Run DMC looks like children next to them in the music video.
well, that's the thing. I will say, you know, I think of these people like Run DMC, and even growing up as a kid, everybody's automatically an adult to you, and like an adult.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were like, I'm guessing like 19.
Yeah, you know, 20s.
19, 20.
Early 20s.
Like early 20s. Yeah, I don't even think they were
What's
like 25. I think
looks
they're
like he
21.
Was 57.
Yeah. So they were super young at this time. And then, yeah, you know, Steven Tyler, they look grown up.
Mm-hmm. Grown.
So, but it's awesome. Cool. The awesome things that can come together when you, I will say, I love that. And I'm pretty sure I've said it before on this podcast. I miss that. I miss how songs were taken from the past and then kind of redone by new artists or done in collaboration with artists. And so it bridged that gap. But not only that, but it also educated the new generation of what was done before. And that just doesn't happen in the mainstream top 40 music today for whatever reason. But I think that's so awesome when, you know, artists from different generations get together and do stuff and change up songs and make them even cooler and better, and or just put a whole new spin and take on things. And I think that should come back. People should do that again.
The only thing I could think of was Lady Gaga and what's his face?
Oh, Barry Manilow.
Yeah.
Oh no. Yeah. Is it Barry Manilow? No. Not Barry Manilow. It's the older guy. Because yeah, Barry. Because it's
older.
The guy's older. Because Barry Manilow still has his mind. The guy who we're thinking about, he's like actually. Oh, he's, you know, sadly he's going.
Tony Bennett.
There you go. Wow. I just want to let you guys know, Digo got that before I could even type it into Google. Okay. That is, let the record show. Digo, his mind is coming back. His mind is coming back, okay? He's not losing it. Yes, Tony
One cell at
Bennett.
A time.
Yeah. But I mean, there's tons of, even hip-hop artists using samples. You know, we talked about The Police and how then in the 90s, you know, P. Diddy redid Every Breath You Take. And so, yeah, it was a lot of, I mean, I will say hip hop's done that probably most, where they have, you know, taken these songs from decades before.
It's like, it's been like they take it, but it's not like a collab. It's not like the old artist comes back. It's a sample. Or
exactly.
They're not making another track together. It's just borrowing and borrowing and borrowing and whatever. It's easier, I guess.
And I think that's the point that, yeah, instead of really having a collaboration, it's just like I'm taking this song and then
a producer up here takes these two entities and puts them together. It's not even like this artist going with this and saying, oh, I like this. It's like a third producer. It's like, well, these two remix, you know.
Well, sometimes that's the case, or sometimes like in the case of Kanye West, it is, you know, he did Through the Wire, which was his first single, and that's actually a song by Chaka Khan. But it was like he just took the sample and put it on the song, versus like
they weren't
having
in a
her
studio
sing,
recording again together. No,
so there was no, again, to my point of like, there was no crossing, like the music heads like me are going to go investigate and see like, oh, what's this song from? Or maybe I've heard my mom play this song or something. But the average listener is like, oh, this is some cool woman singing and blah, blah. And this is a brand new song versus, you know, this thing with Run DMC and Aerosmith was like a clear, like you're able to see and make the connection of like, oh, who is this rock band? Oh, this rock band has had a whole decade worth of music that let me go check it out. Which is very apparent that it was done together. And I would like to see more of that. Where both artists are completely a part of it versus, yes, just one artist saying like, oh, yeah, this is somebody's song and I'm going to redo it. But even that, nobody even does covers like Lady Marmalade, how that was redone in 2001 with, you know, Christina Aguilera and all those people. Like, nobody even really does that anymore. But anyways, I digress. Okay. I'm going to do it, okay? Next album.
Pure covers. Exactly. Covers only by Caleb Hacker.
You can check out my YouTube for that. I have years worth. All right, let's get into funerals now.
Let's get into motherfucking funerals. This is going to come out of left field, but I found it very interesting. I'm going to talk about a musician, Stafford Adji. He's a musician, and he has a particular responsibility to honor the life of the deceased and give a family a little bit more joy in transition. He says, I never liked considering a funeral being a gig because I'm just performing for somebody's homegoing ceremony. Now, this Stafford guy, he's a member of the Rebirth Brass Band. He's a trombonist. Is that how you say it? A person with a trombone. And he is in New Orleans, a city of musical traditions. He connects with all of those that came before him in this ritual of remembrance and celebration. Car-lined streets transformed into walls of a spiritual place filled with solemnity and laughter. So what am I talking about? And for the black folk in New Orleans, you know what I'm talking about. Funeral processions or second lines or jazz funerals, commonly called by observers. And they have existed for generations. Now, have you ever witnessed this in person or seen it? Or you know what I'm talking about, though?
I think I maybe know what you're talking about,
Awesome. So like, I have no clue. For a long period of my life, but there's a specific reason I'm going to get to it later. But anyway, okay. So in its simplest form, the second line is a parade, a mass of celebrants, mourners that weave their way through the streets of New Orleans. And it is one of many sacred cultural rites that have originated in the crucible of American slave trade and is proudly maintained to this day. And the term second line is because it refers to the crowd of members, community members, and mourners that follow the first line of the parade, which is the casket, the family, and the musicians. So basically, the family and the casket and, you know, their hired musicians lead, and then it's anybody in New Orleans follows. Anybody. There are community events, of course, and sometimes hundreds of people join the procession. Quote, I come from the era when you're in your house and you hear music and you go, second line, and you run outside, says Osseta Amor Amenkum, big queen of the Washita Nation and an artistic director of Kumbuka African Drum and Dance Collective and adjunct professor of dance at Tulane University. Ooh, girl, what a title. For her, the dancing typical in the second line allows each individual to uniquely express themselves and also invite to be a chorus of bodies where one collective movement becomes part of a mourning practice to mourn the person that has been lost. So, for example, family and fans took to the streets to celebrate the life of pioneering bounce rapper Josephine Johnny Watson. He died in December, last December at 45. The city held second lines for him, and they held second lines for all sorts of people, from Prince to Betty White. Mm. So in New Orleans, grief doesn't exist without dancing, without laughter, movement of bodies, crowds, and that reminder that death, no matter how somber, is part of your life. So in a world desperate for collective mourning, we talk a lot about collective trauma, and yes, that happens. But so to mitigate the effects of that, here is collective mourning that New Orleans second line funeral rituals serve as much needed resource and a source of inspiration and catharsis. So for the past 2 years, though, we've seen how ill-equipped the world is to deal with persistent grief. The kind that rises up when millions die suddenly within months of each other. Or this article was written before World War III, so World War III.
oh, no.
Right? It's like they didn't even get to it. So it's almost impossible to fully grasp the reality of the deaths. And as politics and overtaxed systems obscure the accuracy of the loss, so many have to bear all of this grief alone. And that isolation has led to the feeling that pain and sadness is singular, perhaps unsurmountable. So, again, there has been very little in the way of national mourning in the events here in the United States. And efforts at federal legislation for bereavement leave have been slow moving. Over the past year alone, suicides in teenagers, tic-like disorders in adolescents, substance abuse, all on the rise. So this unattended grief has real consequences in our bodies, in our communities. Enter the African, Caribbean, and indigenous cultures, if they could only, and they could save the world, dude, whose fingers are wrapped around New Orleans' understanding of life and all of its life cycles. The second line are the lungs, its breath, and its room for anyone wanting to have a place to grieve their losses, no matter how amorphous or distant. The grief traditions of Black New Orleans are intricate and intentional and distinctly New Orleans. A cultural expression that comes from the community, it's a language. That culture expression is a language, and people around the world grieve, you know, in their mother tongue. So they grieve in their own language. And the second line, it may not be a universal language, but it can provide a blueprint for how to normalize and this sort of ritual of collective grieving.
Mm-hmm.
A regular celebration of this kind in communities across the world could serve as a reminder that while grief is persistent and cannot be diminished, it can be carried together. Communal grieving, funeral processions, collective altars, and artwork allow us the time needed to pause and honor both the sadness and the light of the person that was lost, or people. Changing our orientation towards collective grieving means building traditions that allow us to feel the full range of the emotions as well. So, you know, to honor the people we love and to honor the people we never even had a chance to meet in all of the emotions, both sadness and happiness and laughter and everything. So funeral processions in New Orleans always begin with a dirge. That's a slow, mournful version of the gospel hymn, "Just a Closer Walk with Thee." A dirge then just leads the grieving family and community members out of a funeral service and into the open air. It's kind of like the end of a movie, they say. When the credits start rolling, the music changes, the movie changes, and everything changes. Now it's time to celebrate. And the procession makes its way onto the main streets, and that's where the body is, quote, cut loose, as the musicians form a tunnel through which the body passes on its way to the cemetery and onto the next life. The dirge ends, and as the body and the family go on to the burial ground, the tempo and tenor of the processional dramatically change. The casket proceeds to its final resting place, and the air becomes full with fluttering of handkerchiefs, sometimes emblazoned or, you know, with the name or the image of the one who's lost, raised high. They have intricate umbrellas that are held aloft and, you know, kind of dancing with them. As the bearers sway and move and dance. There is buck jumping. The body is gliding over the pavement, fences and porches, and sometimes cars. Voices lift together, encouraging, laughing, teasing. At its heart, the second line is all about touching. Touching the memory of the person who is gone, the lineage of the people who have gone before them, and the people around who you also have left behind. So regardless of the labels that we put on ourselves, black, white, left, right, up, down, whatever, at the end of the day, we are born and we die. So coming together to acknowledge that, that rites of passage to the next realm is real and that it unites us. And the funerary rites that New Orleans culture has allows for clear identification of that commonality that we, again, all have. Now, I'm going to show you a clip of, by the way, that was from an article of Vox.com. "The New Orleans Funeral Reminds Us That Grief is a Burden That Can Be Shared" by Nicole Young. I'm going to show you a clip of a James Bond movie, and you'll be able to see a second line, and it is what happened is it's the beginning of the movie. They're killing 00 agents, and in this scene we see the death of one of the 00 agents, and who is killed in a funeral procession. But you get to see exactly what I've just been talking about. This is like as it is. It's a good example. So here you go.
Whose funeral is it?
Yours.
Thank you.
I've known that scene for my whole life. Like, so I've always like known of these things, and I saw this article and I was like, oh, that's so cool that they're bringing in this, and also, you know, telling like, dude, this is what we need. We need this because it's, you know, but so that was Live and Let Die, the 1973 James Bond film starring Roger Moore. And that was his first film. And just a little thing about that is like, so this is this is his first as now the new Bond. Dude, Live and Let Die. What a choice for an outing for the first, because up until this point, James Bond movies have been so problematic in all sorts of ways. I mean, you look back into a 60s James Bond, I mean, sexism, racism, all the isms. And they were like, let's make up for it. And one one bang, this entire movie is so black. So black. The bad guy is black. The reason why we're watching this funeral procession is because it's one of many scenes of different black people. Like, we go to Harlem next. We go to... I think Jamaica, and it's just like, we just see all these like different, and then, but of course, in the center of all is white boy.
It's the white guy. Anyway,
it's white guy. So this movie included a jazz funeral, the second line. So as you saw, it's very clear, the first line of the mourners, the second line of the party people. And this one took place in the movie, took place on Chartres Street in the French Quarter. And Roger Moore said about it, he said, quote, that it was great being in New Orleans. It was just a wonderful place to be. I loved French Quartering. It was such a tremendous excitement to be in New Orleans. Softshell crabs. And what I liked particularly was going and listening to jazz. It was fascinating to be there. I wish I didn't have to work the whole time. And in the movie, it was the infamous Olympia Brass Band. That had the notable part, and where they led that funeral procession, and it was trumpeter Alvin Alcorn that you saw in that movie, in that clip, that stabs the double O agent. So this is kind of cool. I kind of incorporated a brass band into the movie, like legitimately showing them and showcasing it. So for those of you that were listening, you can obviously Google search Live and Let Die funeral scene, watch this episode on YouTube, or head to our website, anshumanstars.com, and watch our YouTube. So that is my short quick presentation of funeral processions and how they might be better incorporated into our societies. I would love to have that send off.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. That's cool.
And there was much other in the article I just took out because, you know, I don't need to talk about COVID at all times, but obviously these have been stumped by COVID, and that's part of, there's an issue right now. People are saying we haven't had our chance to grieve because we haven't had a chance to gather publicly. It's, you know, I'm sure maybe it's now it's changed because, again, that article was written a few months ago. But yeah, I get it. Like, if you have a way to mourn in such a specific way, and you can, like, you that one person said, like, I looked forward to it. How cool had ever said that before? I look forward to a funeral because it means song and dance and that kind of energy. And to not have that, especially in these times, like, I can probably see, I can understand the stress that people would have. And also, a good, you might, you know, I don't know. You like I said, like, there's languages of grief, but you might want to adopt this language. Might feel good.
I love the part in there where they talked about how we now know the world does not know how to deal with like collective grief, collective trauma. You know, forget just us as individuals. Like, we,
Betty White died and then to say, oh, I like a little comment on the Reddit post. That's not grieving.
Yeah.
Them getting out and grieving for a white woman they've never seen. mm-hmm. you know, in real life, you know, yeah, that don't, yeah, not directly met. Related, never but met. You still grew up with her. You feel that loss and mm-hmm. you just give a ceremony of that feels well-rounded.
Yeah, know? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's so true. And I did, okay, so I did not know what you were talking about. I thought, no, that I'd never seen that before. I didn't even know that was a thing. So that's awesome. I think it's also just beautiful, you know, so in a lot of Christian funerals, they will say, you know, this isn't a funeral, this is a homegoing. And just the idea is to change this from being such a sad thing to like, hey, we can celebrate their life. They're in a better place now, even though, you know, we do miss them. But that along with what they're doing of like kind of grieving, but then we're gonna have a good time. We're gonna celebrate is
there's room I do for think both. There's, like yeah, there's total that the first line, you're up there probably crying your heart out. You're not dancing, you know, you really feel the loss, followed by a bunch of people who are having a great time, drunk and having a good old fashioned, and both are okay. Like,
well, not only that, I just think it's good. Beautiful. It's kind of beautiful yeah. because, because in grief or like dealing with grief, if you're actually dealing with it, that is where, follow me here. Mm-hmm. I think that is where a lot of the grief comes from is that you're thinking of all the good times or all the fun times and you're like, oh, I can't have those anymore. And I think it's a beautiful thing to really have them together of like, I'm really sad, but then I'm also, we're gonna have fun. We're gonna party. And I mean, I don't know what their exact, but yeah, just this like, hey, we're gonna celebrate this person's life and just life in general is, I think that's a beautiful kind of thing.
And anybody
hold.
Can join.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have
exactly.
to know the person.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then,
there's
and
like, that's
real.
What it is. There's like a togetherness. It's a little bit of like a community aspect that mm-hmm. whole. Yeah.
And that's totally real because like we do some like, you know, like your coworker so-and-so dies and mm-hmm. you know, you're like, oh, I'm sorry for your, it's like, so there is involvement. Like we are usually involved in other people's loss, but it sort of seems more indirect. This is a very direct involvement of somebody's loss because you're physically present. And even if it is part of the second line,
mm-hmm.
you were there. You're learning about the person or you're having fun. It's not like everybody in the second line doesn't know the person, you know. It's like, you know, you choose what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You choose if you want to cry, you choose if you want to laugh. So yeah, I'm very fascinated with
yeah, it is
this sort of expression of grief and how it can totally be beneficial.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm just sitting here thinking, I'm like, I'm sure there are some ways where that could be annoying.
I'm sure.
Like, where like you're really grieving and then it's like they partied in the back. So on the other hand, I'm like, yeah, I could kind of see how that might, you know,
again, it's your language, so if like if it doesn't make yeah. sense to you, then obviously it's not gonna work.
Exactly.
But if you're like struggling with something, I just give it a try. I mean, mm-hmm. so people do it to people who have long been dead, you know. It doesn't have to be like, oh, they just died and carry the casket. The people will carry posters of somebody, you know. So it doesn't have to be now. It could be before. It could be just
later.
You know, you never celebrated the death of Prince, you know, and you still have that in you.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this is pre-COVID, but and we're hopefully going to get back to this. But in New Orleans, you go to the police station. And you say, I want a parade. And they ask you, okay, how many people are going to be in parade? Uh-huh. And do you have a route or do you want us to make you a route? And you're like, you can make, I don't know, suggest a route. Like, oh, yeah, you should go down this street. Okay, is that good? Okay, cool. When? All right, cool. Done. And you show up and a little group of police officers just kind of walk with you as you do. And your parade could be two people. You pay the fine, you set the date, you do everything, and you just have your parade. And that's just how it is. So like, this could be done to yeah, at least in New Orleans. Like, you know, anybody can set up this, you know, sort of parade, but can be a second line. Mm-hmm. There's no reason, you know, it's this kind of same energies, really, to be honest. I really like those umbrellas.
I know.
This is really cool.
He had the feathers and everything. I was like, okay.
I think that's still a thing. Cool. Of course, that was the 70s, so there was a lot more flair in that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the umbrellas are still part of it. And I think there's a little bit of, I didn't get too into it, but this movie kind of gets a little into it. There's a little bit of, you know, there's like witchcraft and stuff from
like voodoo or whatever.
You know, I don't want to just say voodoo, but like, and I don't want to say witchcraft. That's not what I'm like. Other than Christianity was brought over from Africa, and whatever that remained is what started a lot of this tradition.
Gotcha.
You know, that, you know, and something with umbrellas, you know, it's mm-hmm. just umbrellas have a thing. And it's not the first time I've seen that with traditions. Anywho, good times.
Ooh, good times.
And, good stuff. You know, I'm going to want to change our sign off. And are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'll do the best I can with what I got.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Perfect. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got. Oh, man. The best. The absolute best. No. I will not let you.
I'll do the best I can with what I got.
Hey.